every year, like every week pretty much, I sit around with my team and we look at the average rents and we think, like, at what point do people just stop being able to afford these? And you just wonder at what point people go, do you know what? I can't move now.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy. Higginson Strategy is a PR and public affairs specialist that supports organisations making the world a better place. One such organisation is Spare Room, founded in 2004, and with more than 2 million visits a month, it is the biggest flatmate finding service in the UK and across the world. Home sharing with strangers was once something that most people only really did when they were in their early adult life. However, increases in the cost of living are seeing an increased number of people sharing with others later in life as well. So in 2022, there was a more than 100% increase in people in their 40s looking for flatmates and a 240% increase in people in their 50s and 60s seeking flatmates. Joining me today to discuss why Spare Room exists is the company's communications director, Matt Hutchinson. So Matt has been with Spare Room pretty much since the start. The company was set up by his friend, Rupert Hunt, who he is once in a band with at university. Matt is also a big bluegrass fan. He has his own podcast, Bluegrass Jam Along. So if you're a fan yourself, do check that out. So that brings me nicely into the how you started with Spare Room. Can you just kind of tell us how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, I was at university doing a music degree in a band with Rupert, who founded Spare Room, and we all moved down to London to kind of make our fortune and be rock stars, and that clearly didn't happen. And in the process of working out that that wasn't going to happen, we all shared a flat together, and then we all sort of had to find other things to do, and we sort of drifted into different flat shares, different jobs. I started a career working in the music business. Rupert went off and did some kind of web coding, started working on the site that became Spare Room. And sort of fast forward a few years, he came to me and said, look, I've got this site. I need somebody to write some content. Do you think you can have a go at that? And so I said, yeah, let's give it a go. And that sort of turned into me getting a job working for Rupert. And eventually, you know, a few weeks after that, we got a call from the Chris Evans Show when he was doing the drive time slot on Radio 2 saying, we want to talk about people taking in lodgers. Does one of you want to come on and talk about it? And everybody else said no. And I went, yeah, I'll have a go. And that was sort of the start of me doing the communication stuff, really. And 17 years later, here I am.
Wow. Well, that's a very nice route in, and it's a route that, you know, often people take into their careers. It's one of those ones that you kind of fall in. And if you're listening to this at home, you can't see Matt's great electric guitars in the background, but clearly music's a big part of your life still. But just bring us back to Spare Room. I like to ask why an organization exists. So can you just tell us, why does Spare Room exist? Why does it need to exist?
I think when it started, it needed to exist because although hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people in the UK flat shared, it was a very hidden and slightly ignored bit of the housing market. People found flat shares through ads in local papers or in shop windows or word of mouth. It was a sort of slow, clunky, incredibly painful process. And taking it online seemed like the most useful way of fixing that. And that happened. And it's, you know, most things have gone online now. And there are many benefits of that being the case. But I think now we exist to bring people together. I think living together is not just a financial transaction. It's about sharing your life. It's about living with the right people. It's about all sorts of things, you know, from financial benefits to social benefits and community. And I think Spare Room exists essentially to connect people.
Yeah. So I really like that because I'd kind of mentioned the financial aspect of it. And I think often people think of flat share as being something that you do just for the financial reasons because it's cheaper to share than to be on your own. But I think there's a really good point there that actually for some people, it's a choice. It's not just about the cost of it. There are some real benefits that you can have from sharing home with people and making friends for life and all sorts of other things. So I like the fact that you're communicating in that way. I know that you've done some work over the years, and at Higginson Strategy, we love organisations that look at the problems that are in their industry and try and fix those problems through sometimes legislative change. We often help some of those organisations to do that. I know that you've done a bit of that yourself. Can you tell us a bit about the campaigning you've done in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, we sort of realised after the last financial crash we had, sort of 2008, 10, 15 years ago, there was a massive problem with housing affordability, which, you know, hasn't gone away. But we realised that although there was a shortage of housing and housing was getting very expensive, there were actually millions of empty rooms in people's houses. And we saw a growing trend in people taking in lodgers, like homeowners who were struggling with cost of living, you know, taking in lodgers to help make ends meet. And we thought, well, if we're short of rooms and we're short of supply, and there are some people out there who have capacity and need the help, surely we can join this up a bit. And we discovered there was already a government incentive that existed called the Rent a Room Scheme that allows anybody with a spare room to rent it out and earn some tax-free money. But the amount of money they could earn hadn't been looked at for years and was well out of date. And so we just started campaigning in 2009 to get that increased. It took us 6 years to do it, but we did. And we got the amount you could earn tax-free from your spare room increased to £7,500. And it was a lifeline for a lot of people. You know, I think people look at the housing ladder and think you share, then you rent on your own, then you buy a house, and then everything, once you bought a house, it's fine. But there are so many people in this country who like have a house but don't necessarily have a lot of income. At one end of the spectrum, you've got empty nesters who might have a house but don't have much money coming in. And at the bottom end, you know, people in the 30s have really stretched themselves to get on the property ladder in the first place and might have bought a two-bed flat, but, you know, they're struggling to afford it. And so we just looked at that and thought, well, you know, let's try and do something that will help everybody there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's such a great story. And, you know, if you're one of those people that has rented out a room yourself or even rented from someone else, chances are that you've been helped out by spareroom.com looking at that law, saying that we can do something here and pushing the government for that. We are in a general election year, and there's people that might be listening to this podcast that might be involved in the process of writing those party manifestos. If you could change any law tomorrow, what would it be?
Do you know, I don't think it's the laws that are the issue in a weird way. It's policy. And I know the two are very connected and that policies become law. But I think the reason we struggle with housing in this country is a sort of a lack of ambitious policy. And the reason for it is because we've entered this world where parties are worried about popularity and they're thinking relatively short term, next election, keeping the opposition at bay, whether the opposition is the actual opposition or the opposition is government. Like it's much more of a battle to win than it is to actually fix these generational problems we have. People aren't prepared to take on the 25-year decisions that will sort these things out. And so some of the most important things in the country, like the NHS and like housing, are being dealt with very short-term plans. And I think we just need people who are ambitious, who will look at these, take difficult decisions, take a sort of inspired, empowered approach and get everybody to go along with them, rather than trying to do the things they think will get people to vote for them in a year or two.
Yeah. So lots of UK politicians look to China, which produces 10-year plans and 20-year plans. And it's probably the best example of a country where I think the point you're making there, Matt, is that in the UK, as with most democracies, you work on roughly a 5-year cycle. So politicians struggle to look beyond that 5-year period, where China's been a great example of having policies in place that are based on a 10 or 20-year cycle, which can be far more ambitious. If we were to put in place a larger, more ambitious time frame, and we had 20 years, is there anything that you'd particularly like to do on that kind of policy side?
I think we need to find some places to build more homes. I think that's pretty straightforward. And the argument is always about where. If you say on a national platform, let's build more houses, everybody cheers. If you say on a local platform, let's build some houses here, people suddenly start to worry about all sorts of things, from infrastructure to the price of their house to all sorts of things. But we need to find some places to build more homes. But we also need to think about how we use the ones we've got, because we do actually have enough rooms in this country for everybody to have one. But we've created a country in which we are encouraged to overconsume property when we can afford to. And it makes sense, like it's the most sensible place to put your money because it's always going to keep going up in price. But we need to find a way to kind of make housing more about how you want to live than about a financial decision. And so we need more properties because that will help bring prices down. But I think we also need to find ways to incentivize investment in the private rented sector too, because we've gone through a few years of squeezing private landlords out of the market and not really replacing them with anything. And so we have this huge demand for properties and actually a pretty low level of supply at the moment. So it's about increasing new properties, but also dealing with the ones that we've got better.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point of the fact that in our country in particular, it's seen as that kind of asset class where when you have a certain amount of wealth, you're using a property as an asset in the same way as any investor would invest in anything, or lots of people are. But actually, coming back to the fact that this is people's homes that we're dealing with, and it'd be great if you could be something that could separate the home side and the investment side. Just tell us a bit more about how Spare Room has evolved since your inception, because as a tech company, you have been around for a long time, almost 20 years. How have things changed?
I mean, the company's grown is the obvious one. I think when I started, there were about three or four of us working in a shed on a farm. And we now have, you know, an office in Manchester, an office in London, an office in New York. And we actually turned 20 a few weeks ago, and we got the whole company together and, you know, this room full of people. And it was, you know, just made me reflect on all the staff get-togethers we'd had when there was half a dozen of us, or, you know, that's the obvious change from my point of view. But I think the role that we play, I think, particularly in the UK, as Spare Room has become an integral part of the way property is rented and dealt with, just to see flat sharing getting a bit more attention and not being quite so hidden, and us being able to, I think, like renters in the UK, particularly flat sharers, there are organisations out there who represent the rights of renters and speak on behalf of renters, but actually millions of them use us every year, and we ask them how they feel about stuff, what they want. And we look at the data and we look at the things they're telling us, and we can actually speak on behalf of actual renters. And so I think we have a responsibility to do that. So in the UK, the thing that's changed is we've got very involved with the conversation. And I think that's great, because there are these bits of the housing market, like people taking in lodgers or people flat sharing, that tend to get a bit forgotten about in the big conversations about house prices and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And they're important. Yeah. We need flat sharing for the economy to exist. We need people to be able to live flexibly and affordably in city centres and wherever. And so the conversation's changed a bit, but I think essentially the landscape is the same.
Yeah. And I think what's really interesting is that in the UK, about a third of people are renters. But as you say, the mainstream media is often very focused on home ownership and homeowners, so the other two thirds of people, rather than renters. And also, when we look over to the continent, so France or Germany, they've got much more of a culture of renting. In the UK, I think the average stay of people in the UK is around 2 years, whereas in Germany, it's about 10 years. So huge amount longer time in a property on average, which then builds up your connection to that property and your wish to look after the property and everything else as a renter. And I think it'd be great if the UK got closer to that model as well. Have you noticed any significant changes in the UK flat share market over the 17 odd years that you've been with Spare Room?
I think, as you mentioned at the beginning, the ages of people sharing, like the range of ages, but also just as the flat share population gets a bit older. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is just that some people are sharing for longer because they can't afford to rent on their own or to buy. But I think also we're seeing people come out of big life changes, maybe in their 40s, 50s, 60s, who are flat sharing or renting out a room in their home or whatever, because previously, maybe 10, 15 years ago, they wouldn't have needed to. But you know, the cost of living is so expensive. And whatever your situation is now, whether you're a renter or you're a homeowner paying a mortgage, like everybody is more financially squeezed. And so flat sharing has become something that isn't necessarily just something you do for 2 or 3 years in your 20s. It's become a way of life for a lot of people. And I think you're right that we are a bit obsessed with home ownership, and home ownership is great in many, many ways. I think it contributes to people feeling invested in their local area. I think there's financial benefits to it. But I think what we really need is a housing market that supports people wherever they are in their life, at whatever point they're at, to have somewhere secure and affordable and safe for them to go out and get on with living their life. And I think the worry is we've invested so heavily in home ownership that it is now, people see it as some sort of failing if they don't manage to buy a house. And it's not people not buying houses who've failed. It's the system that is failing those people. And the real worry is, you know, when a generation who don't own their homes retire, how are they going to afford to live when they don't have an asset they can sell or downsize or take money out of? Are we suddenly going to have to be paying housing benefit for everybody who doesn't own a home from retirement onwards? I think we're letting people fall through the gaps, and we are letting home ownership dominate the conversation in a way that it sort of makes sense, because home ownership is financially really sensible if you can afford to do it. But I just think it excludes so many people and they suffer as a result.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. What happens when Generation Rent reaches retirement age? And I think that's a conversation that not enough people are having. You told us at the beginning that you came into Spare Room on the back of a interview request for Chris Evans' show. What's been one of your biggest communications wins over the years?
I think it's funny. I think we look to big wins, but I think the truth of it is, with anything like this, it's the daily little wins that count. It's the kind of, I think sometimes you can get obsessed with like one big campaign or one big idea or this thing that's going to shift the needle. And actually, I think just committing to positive ongoing messaging all the time. And I know that's like maybe not the fashionable answer, but I do think like with our PR in the UK, we've been doing it week in, week out for the past 17 years. And it's that commitment to putting the messages out and keeping going. And you don't always get it right. And some things do really fly. But even like what I would describe as a big win, like getting the rent a room scheme threshold change, that took us 6 years to do. It wasn't like we spent 2 months on a campaign and there it was. We talked to people consistently for 6 years about it.
Yeah, no, I hear that a lot. And, you know, I think especially new forms of media will kind of try to sell people the idea that you'll get this kind of hockey stick graph of things going along and you get one particular thing and it will just send everything shooting up. But lots of people say it's actually just grinding it out, working hard, doing those things bit by bit. That's the way to go forward. What that you've done do you feel has made the biggest difference in the world?
I think just bringing some forgotten bits of the flat share market out into the light a little bit more, making it more visible and making it more talked about. And with that comes all the difficulties around the issues around housing. But I think it's more positive that it's all out there. It's online. There's like, it's not this little hidden bit of the market anymore. I think making it visible and talking about it, consistently talking about it, I think that's what makes the difference. And just helping people feel that, like, as you say, most people flat share for financial reasons, but if you take a bit of time to find the right people to live with, it can also be like a great year of your life, picking some people to live with. Like some of the best years of my life have been sharing very average properties with great people. And, you know, just making that part of the conversation as well, celebrating the good stuff that comes out of it, even when it's difficult and it's unaffordable and people are stressed, celebrating that positive things come out of actually being around people, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe where some of us get those things wrong. We all think about, when we're thinking about where we're going to live, we think where it's going to be, what our budget is, and maybe what the property is like. And then maybe think about the flatmates and people that you're going to share with last. But, you know, who you're living with should come top of that list. It's probably the most important thing. What's one of your favorite forms of communication, or some of your favorite forms of communication and media?
I mean, I'm going to say this obviously, but I love a podcast. I like a long form interview. I think media has got fragmented and bitty, and like a bit like politics, like short term clicks and wins and attention. And, you know, even things like the BBC website, you look on the BBC homepage and some of the headlines are quite clickbaity now. And when you click through, the bit of content that you're going to isn't really what you think you're going to get. They've just picked a sensational bit of it to get your attention. And so I like a slow, longer form conversation where you can go into detail, because I think that's where you really find stuff out rather than 5 or 10 minutes and getting the 3 answers to questions that people normally give you. I think you need to dig deeper. And I think particularly in terms of housing, it's such a nuanced thing that if you do short form stuff and you get clickbaity, you end up with tenants good, landlords bad, government incompetent, and that's your headline. And there's so much more nuance in the housing situation in terms of the struggles landlords are going through, but also homeowners. And also, like, there's so many complicated bits in there that I think we miss the opportunities to really get to the heart of it when everything is so fast-paced and attention-grabbing.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. But it also brings us to a headline that was this week, was that the Labour Party is looking to put a cap on the increase that can fall on renters. Did you see that headline this week?
There's headlines about that all the time, particularly when there are elections looming. And I think it's going to get attention because people like the idea that somebody is trying to have an effect on how expensive rents get. But I think the point is that you can cap rents and you can stop them going up. Now, you could fix rents now and say rents can't go up for 5 years, but they're still unaffordable. It's like, you know, it's a stable door and horse situation. The problem's happened. You can slow it down from getting any worse, but it's not how much rents go up by now that is the problem. It's how much rents have gone up by in the past 5 years that's the problem. Yeah. You know, every year, like every week pretty much, I sit around with my team and we look at the average rents and we think, like, at what point do people just stop being able to afford these? And we had that conversation 10 years ago. We had it 5 years ago. We had it yesterday. And you just wonder at what point people go, do you know what? I can't move now. I'm just going to stay here.
God. What do you think's been one of your biggest failures?
Oh, I love these questions. Messaging, you're always going to get stuff wrong. You are always, even with the best of intent. And sometimes it's the stuff that isn't trying to be controversial that you get wrong. And we did a tube campaign. So back in September, October 2022, the market was just ridiculous. There were something like nine times as many people looking for rooms as there were rooms available. Like, rents were shooting up. People were being asked to queue around the block for open viewings, submit written statements to rent a room. Like, it was just nuts. People were overpaying, people were going into bidding wars. And like all the stuff about homeowners having extra capacity, and also with interest rates going up and the sort of calamitous effect that the mini budget had had. And it made absolute sense to try and encourage homeowners to rent out their spare rooms. So we did a tube campaign saying, look, if you've got a spare room, you can make some tax-free money and help the housing crisis. And it just got misconstrued, or we got it wrong. I'm not really sure which, but people reacted to it as though we were trying to encourage homeowners to profit from the misery of renters, which is the opposite of what we were trying to do. But you can't always control how your messaging lands. You hurl these messages out into the world and you don't know who's going to catch them and what they're going to think when they do. And I think some people are just looking for negative ways to interpret this stuff, but for whatever reason and however it happened, we got that wrong. And it ended up, you know, just people complaining about it all over social media, and a thing that we were doing to try and help actually, you know, just backfired. And you never know when those are going to happen.
No, it was a very, very difficult time. And actually at that time we were working with Airbnb as a client, and they were getting a lot of negative press as well, which we helped them with, around the fact that they were still staying open. So they said that that was potentially spreading the virus and that Airbnb should force everyone to shut down. But we did a positive campaign with them around, lots of hosts were willing to give away their Airbnb for free to people that were on the front line, so NHS workers and others. And we pushed out that story, which helped to push back on all the negative press that Airbnb was getting around people keeping their holiday lets open and that spreading the virus. But as you say, it was a very difficult time a couple of years ago during lockdown, and everyone was feeling frightened and worried about things, and lots of messages weren't landing as they would in normal times. What for you makes a good message?
I think simplicity, essentially. I think most forms of communication, unless you're talking about a long-form interview, most things can only really get one thing across. And I think people sometimes, and it's difficult because so many things need context. So many messages require some supporting context. But clarity on what the thing you're trying to say is, because sometimes, like, even us communications professionals don't put out a clear bit of comms. Like, what are you actually trying to say? And I think there's attached to that, it's a secondary point about positive communication and the thing you are trying to say and the thing that you do stand for. Because I think sometimes we can get so caught up in what we're not and what we don't stand for and what we're against. And I think politics suffers from that at the moment. And I think if the parties just came out and said, this is what we stand for, we believe in this really strongly, we've thought about it, we've listened to people, we've got these big ideas, come with us, you'd feel much better about it than going, vote for us because we're not them. Like, vote for us because we're not them is a rubbish way to conduct politics. You know, here's what we're not. Great, but like, what are you? That's what we need to know. We need some positive, clear communication across the board, and then we'll make our own minds up. Like, we're perfectly capable of doing that. But I think we've just got into this. Like, stuff gets a bit combative and a little bit like a sport rather than, you know, it's one-upmanship and pointing out the faults of the opposition rather than just being clear about what you are and being positive and, you know, marching ahead with that.
What do you do to unwind when you're not working?
I play music. I walk my dog, which is sometimes more stressful because she can be a little bit a little bit aggy sometimes when she's in the wrong mood.
What kind of dog do you have?
The podcast that I do. Oh, she's half border terrier and half poodle, so she's sort of scruffy and fluffy, and she's like, right. And my wife always compares her to Barbara Windsor in the Get Out of My Pub moment in EastEnders. She's perfectly sweet, and then all of a sudden she'll just decide that everybody needs to get out of the pub and shout at them.
Yeah, I've got a poodle cross, I've got a Cavapoo, and they have got a lot of energy, certainly. And final question, what message would you give to your younger self?
I would say, what would I say? Something along the lines of, you can plan as much as you like, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen. Like, get on with the thing you're doing, have a plan, and just don't stress about the little stuff too much. Like, I think your time frame at different ages in your life becomes very different. And I think there's something about being young and just feeling like you are limitless and you will be here forever and nothing really matters that is really, really good because you just get on and do stuff. But I think there's also something that comes from being older. Like, I don't know. There's things that, like, in hindsight, if I could not have done them or done differently, I would. But at the same time, it all gets you to where you're going and it all gets you to the place you're at. And I think if I could just tell my younger self to not stress as much and just don't presume that people are judging you for stuff. Presume that nobody's looking at you at all and you'd probably be much better off.
Yeah. That almost reminds me of one of Mike Tyson's quotes. Everyone's got a plan until you get punched in the face, but slightly different there. But Matt Hutchinson, Communications Director at Spare Room, you've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose. If you'd like to know more about how Higginson Strategy supports purpose-led organisations, go to higginsonstrategy.com. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks for having me.